Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to All Things Therapy. I'm your host, Lisa Tahir. I'm a licensed clinical social worker practicing as an intuitive psychotherapist. I have certifications additionally in Reiki and EMDR. I have physical offices in Los Angeles, California, and New Orleans, Louisiana. However, I provide sessions worldwide with clients wherever you might be living via Skype, FaceTime, and phone. You can find me to schedule sessions or reach out through email about being a guest on this show at nolatherapy.com, the abbreviation for New Orleans, Los Angeles Therapy. And you can subscribe to this show as well as listen to archived episodes on YouTube, iTunes, and Google Play. So I'm going to move into introducing my guest. And as I was thinking about this show and writing some notes, I just thought how it's interesting where life might take us. I imagine that's probably been your experience too as a listener from time to time. And 7 years ago, I never would have thought that I would have an idea that was patent on. Sorry, I'm butchering that word. And a friend, an attorney, introduced me to my guest today. His name is Benji Balzer. He's a partner at Next IP Law Group, LLC, and he specializes in patent drafting and prosecution, in intellectual property, and he offers consultations and reviews. So we're going to talk to him about everything related to intellectual property, patents, trademarks, etc. And I feel really grateful to have met him because I do have a U.S. patent on an invention that I invented to assist people who are in wheelchairs to blow and cast glass as an art form through a modified workbench that I invented that has never existed. And it's just so exciting to make something, to come up with an idea and sketch it out on napkins. And over the years, it becomes, you know, something so substantial and helpful. So welcome, Benji Balzer, on the show today.
Hi, Lisa.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for being my guest today.
Sure.
So I don't know where you'd like to start. A couple of directions we can take would be either how did you get into patent law or the patent system in general? Where do you prefer starting?
We can just share through the patent system to start with.
Okay, tell us about what the patent system is, because I didn't know much about it until I started my own process.
So first off, many people think that the patent, when they're granted, gives you the right to build something and to make something and sell it. In reality, it actually allows you to prevent other people from producing and selling it. So you may actually do your patent may actually, if you practice it, may infringe on somebody else's patent. But you can stop somebody from making your improvement on their patented invention.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
And the way you can describe it in element form, if you get a patent, generally a claim will say you have a system comprising elements A, B, and C. Okay. And so to infringe that patent, you have to practice each one of those in your device. So A, B, and C. So someone else can actually get a patent on an invention that has a system comprising elements A, B, C, and D. So the D is actually an improvement on the original invention.
Okay.
So the person that has A, B, and C can still stop you from doing it, but you can stop him from making the same improvement that you made.
Interesting. So that's why you have on your website talking about doing patents and prosecution when these issues arise.
Right. There's two different sides to getting a patent. There's the drafting of the patent application and filing it, and that's generally called preparation. And then the prosecution side is working with the patent office to get the claims allowed. So there are three basic parts to a patent application. There are the drawings, which are pretty self-explanatory. There's a detailed description, which uses the drawings to explain how to reproduce the invention. And you have to describe it in such a way that one of ordinary skill in the art can reproduce the invention without undue experimentation.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third part of the application is the claims. And in the claims, that's the technical description of what you're protecting. So, like I said earlier, there's a system with elements A, B, and C, and how those elements interact with each other.
So the claims would be what this device, to use that word, does, the claim it's making to do?
Yes, and you try and describe it in as broadly a manner as possible, but still describing what you're doing so that you can get as much protection as possible.
Okay, got it. In my case, I know I had worked on for years the description and the claims, but it were the drawings, the AutoCAD and stuff, you know, that's out of my wheelhouse that I tried to farm out and then that you helped me with. And then even the language in the claims and such had to be it was like a foreign language to me, this whole patent process. It is a specific language, correct, that you're using with the patent office to make this a reality.
Yes, and that language has evolved through the court system in interpreting certain words. For example, there's two words that are used normally in a preamble of a claim. The one that's used most often is comprising, which is an open-ended word. So that means that you can have elements A, B, and C, and then anything else. If it's consisting, if you would say a system consisting of elements A, B, and C, that's a closed-ended word. And so there's nothing else that would be included in the invention that would affect the basic operation of it.
Okay. And so before we came live, I had asked you, are you able to help people with securing a patent anywhere in the country? And you said yes, because it's a federal system. Can you talk to us about that?
Correct. So the patent system is federally based. So I just have to have a license in any state in the United States. Personally, I might have in Georgia. That's where I started my practice.
Right.
But I can help anyone in any state as long as it's I'm filing with the patent office in Washington, D.C.
That's excellent.
I can also help. Right. So not only just people in the U.S., I have clients in foreign countries as well that I file applications in the U.S. And then
that's
I can
very
also
cool.
take. Right, and then I can take the U.S. applications and work with foreign counsel to file them in the foreign countries as well.
Okay. So can you kind of walk us through what is the patent process? If a client calls you after the show and says they have an idea they want to talk to you about, what does that process look like in working with you? What are the costs associated with it? So our listeners can know in case they want to they want to give you a call.
So what we would do is schedule a disclosure meeting. And in the disclosure meeting, we'll go over three basic parts of the description of what I would need to file. The first is a description of the current state of the art. So typically there's a problem that the invention tries to solve.
Okay.
But right now that problem is, I mean, it's usually addressed in some manner, but there's some deficiency to it. And so you talk about what is going on in the state of the art right now and how they're trying to address a particular problem. So it might do this, but there's a problem with the way that it's done. My invention works differently. So the second part of it is how it works. And then the third would be how it addresses the problems and fixes the problems that the current state of the art has. Then I take that information and then I draft the patent application. So I start with the drawing. I work with the inventor on how to draw up the facets of the particular invention. And then there's the detailed description. So I use the drawings and describe every little bit of the invention and how it works. and then draft the claims, which, like we said, are the technical description of how everything works and how it works together.
Okay, great. So you do that for your clients. And like I tried to do as much of that on my own, which is why it took so many years until I found you.
Right. Now you have two different types of applications that you were working on. One is a design patent and the other one was a utility patent.
Yes.
So the one that we have now that we got issued is the design patent.
Yes.
And a design patent covers the ornamental aspects of the invention. So what it looks like.
It's
the structure of how it's built. But it doesn't cover any of the functionality of the design. So
right.
the utility application covers the functional aspect. And that one is still in prosecution. We actually have an office action right now that we have to respond to within the next couple of months.
Okay, great. So when a client comes in, do you help them decide which type of patent they want to do or both, for instance?
Yes. Okay. And sometimes there's also a copyright aspect to it. If you can look at it as a work of art, you can also file a copyright for it. And that's another thing we can cover a little later is the different aspects of intellectual property law. Some people don't know when a patent or a copyright or a trademark is the appropriate way to protect their intellectual property.
Okay, cool. So you can help someone determine those three things.
Absolutely.
So what are costs associated with this process?
Okay, so with a normal non-provisional utility patent, my preparation fees are normally somewhere between $5,000 to $7,000. And
okay.
That's just the number of hours. It usually takes 20 to 25 hours to address all the issues in drafting the patent application. And then there's filing fees, which most clients are going to be small entities. There's three levels of fees. One is large entity, which is a large company with over 500 employees. One is a small entity, which is less than 500 employees. And then there's also now a micro-entity level, which is half of the small entity. And so you cannot have filed more than two applications previously and had income in the previous year of over $150,000 or somewhere in that range.
To be a micro-entity.
Right, you qualify. And that's half of the fees of the small entity.
Right, the fee goes down as the entity size goes down.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
And so then those fees, a small entity fee is somewhere around $700, $730, something in that range. There may be some drawing fees involved too, which vary depending on the type of drawing, how intricate the drawings are. If they're just boxes and system diagrams, it's pretty simple. If it's a complex mechanical product that has gears and all kinds of other stuff in it, the drawings may be a little more expensive, but they range somewhere in between $50 to $100 a page.
Okay. And is that the beginning phase then? And working?
Yes, and that's the file the application. And it normally has taken 2 to 3 years for the patent office to get around to examining the application. They've recently been pushing to reduce that time. And I've had some that have come back in about a year lately. So that's actually a pretty pretty nice to get it back in a year. But you should typically see somewhere between 2 to 3 years before you get an examination back from the patent office.
Wow, yeah.
I'd say probably in the mid to upper 90s, 90 percentile, you'll get rejections of all your claims. Just kind of the nature of the beast. They can find something that's close, and so they want something on record to say, you know, this is what we've looked at, and we've rejected the patent for these reasons. So,
and then they give you time, right? Is that when they give you time to make corrections? Yes.
Right. You get 6 months to respond to the office action. And the first 3 months is at no fee, and then after that, there's monthly extensions for the first month, second month, and third month. But normally you can respond to it within the 3 months, no problem. When you look at the office action and the rejection, you have to determine whether you agree with the examiner or not. If you don't agree with the examiner, you can just file arguments to try and overcome his rejection. On the other side, you may agree with the examiner, but you may be able to amend the claims to get around the rejections and to get around the art that he cited in the rejection.
Okay. Yeah, I was intimately familiar with this process to our listeners, having started on my own by going to the USPTO.gov, that is the United States Patent and Trademark Office website, and filing, you know, this patent process on my own. And my examiner and I felt like we had letters going on every couple 2 to 3 months for years, you know, me trying to correct. It started with a list of, say, 30 questions. Then I got down to, say, 20, 10, until it was the last couple that of questions that my attorney friend referred me to you, because they weren't answerable by just a person who's not a patent attorney. It's a specific language, and certain, like, I Google, what do these terms mean, you know, in the letters, and I tried to answer the best that I could. So it is so helpful to have you navigate this process for someone in my own personal experience. Right.
Yeah, I've had several clients that have come to me where they've filed the applications on their own. And, you know, it's something that you can look at and say, oh, I think I can do that. But you have to understand the law behind why you're doing
right.
it to be able
right.
to write it. And that's something that I've you know, as a patent attorney, I've spent years reading through things and working and learning to understand what language to use and the best way to write the claim. So
then what happens next, Benji? So it might be, say, 2 to 3 years for the examiner to get to the application, and then what happens?
So you get basically two bites at the apple. So you get an examination of the first claims that you submit. Then you get the opportunity to either argue or to make amendments. If you make amendments, that's your second examination for your filing fee. If you can't get it to an agreement with the examiner to get it to issue or to be allowable at that point, then you can actually file a request for continued examination, which is called an RCE, and you get two more bites at the apple. Then you can keep continuing to do that throughout until you get either you run out of money or you can't come to an agreement on what the claims are.
Right.
So the other option is, if you can't come to an agreement with the examiner and you just think that he's wrong and he thinks that you're wrong, you can file an appeal. And the appeal ends up going to the Patent Trial and Appeal Board. There's a panel. I believe it's three judges on the panel. And they review the examiner's arguments and your arguments. And there's some appeal brief that you file and present all your arguments. And then the examiner files an answer. And then the applicant gets to file a reply brief as well. So then the PTAB, the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, reviews all that and makes a decision on whether to affirm the examiner's rejections or to force the examiner to go back and reopen the case.
Okay.
And that takes a long time as well. I've had some that have taken 2 to 3 years at that point for the appeal to be decided. So there is a backlog in the system, and they're trying to alleviate that, but it'll take some time to get to that point.
So for our listeners, which you probably are noticing by hearing Benji speak, this process is a commitment. It is a time commitment, a financial commitment to seeing your idea through to the end. So then what happens once everyone's on the same page, the examiner, you, the inventor? Then what?
So I'm assuming you get to an allowance at that point where the examiner says that the claims that you have are allowable over the art that he has cited, that he can find in his searches. So once it's allowed, then you get a notice of allowance, and you have to pay an issue fee. Once you pay the issue fee, the patent issues. It takes another couple of months to get to that point.
Yeah.
And then it's printed up and mailed out to you.
And it's glorious, beautiful folder with the American flag on it that I have tucked away in my hurricane evacuation box should I need to evacuate again. That glorious file, when it finally comes to you, it feels so good.
Yeah.
So how did you get into this, Benji? How can you tell our listeners where you started as a younger man in your education? And
sure. My uncle is a patent agent in Los Angeles.
Right.
And when I'd go out to visit him, we'd go out and visit in the summers fairly regularly. And he would always show me things that he was working on. He'd say, let me show you this invention that we filed a patent on, and it does this. It was always really interesting to me to see all these neat things that he was working on.
So cool.
And so, yeah, it was something that I was always interested in. And it was kind of targeted. That's kind of what I targeted my education for. I didn't exactly understand at the time what I needed to sit for the patent bar. So as a patent attorney, you have to have pass the legal bar. That's on the legal side. On the patent side, you have to pass the patent bar. And there's a patent bar exam that you have to sit for, and there's a manual patent examining procedure that you kind of have to learn. And there's all kind of timings and dates and procedures, and it's basically the set of patent laws that you have to follow. So you have to sit for that exam, and to sit for it, you have to have some kind of engineering degree or applied sciences, like a chemistry or physics or biology, just to sit for it. So I was in school, and I started off in engineering, but at that time in my life, didn't really like some of those classes that I was sitting in.
Okay.
So I switched to business and ended up talking to my uncle, and he's like, so how'd you study going? What are you studying? I said, well, right now I'm in business. And he said, no. You have to get an engineering. Business is not going to work if you want to go into patent law. So then I switched back, and I asked him which one he recommended. He recommended electrical engineering.
Okay.
So that had the broadest set of patent work to work on. So,
so you had to go through everything to become an electrical engineer first.
Right. So first you would get your electrical engineering degree or any engineering degree or biology or chemistry, physics, whatever. And then after that, you could actually become a patent agent without going to law school. So you can, if you pass the patent bar with just an engineering degree, you can be a patent agent. But you can't do any litigation off the patent work. And that's another side we haven't even talked about yet. But as a patent attorney, after you get your undergrad degree, then you go to law school, get your law degree, and then you can take the patent bar as well. Any time after.
Finish your sentence, and then I'll say, Benji, at any time after.
Right, so any time after you get your undergrad degree, you can take the patent bar. You don't have to wait until after you get out of law school to take it.
Something, and you are used to having patience, just the process with the multiple degrees, the multiple bars, licenses, you know, wow, it's such a commitment to do what you're doing.
Yeah. It's always that light at the end of the tunnel thing, way off in the distance. But then once you get to the end of the tunnel, it's a big light there. So.
Yeah. And then isn't your uncle 82 and still doing some work now in Los Angeles with Pat? Awesome.
Yeah, it's a mental job, really. So, as long as he still has his mental capabilities, he can still do the job.
Yeah, that's awesome. I bet he's really proud of you.
Yeah, it's fun to talk to him about different things, too.
Definitely. So you mentioned just a few moments ago, litigation. Do you want to segue into that?
Right. So it's not something that I do a lot in my practice. So the prosecution, preparation and prosecution side is obtaining the patent from the patent office. Then the other side, if somebody infringes the patent, that's where the litigation side comes in. And so if you find that someone is infringing on your patent, you can sue them for patent infringement.
So let me ask you a question about that. How would you know if someone has infringed upon your patent? What are some examples?
Generally, they'll be producing a product that does the same thing that yours does. Can be a very sticky question sometimes if the process is internal to a device. A lot of times, you can't see what a particular, a computer chip or a semiconductor chip that's in a device, it's hard to tell that it's doing what you're doing, but you can see that it has the same outcome that your improvement did. And so you can start the process and then through discovery find out what that device is doing internally to see if they're infringing your claims. I mean, there's others that are just outright copies of a mechanical device, and you can tell pretty easily that it's doing what you're doing.
Okay. Wow. So you, again, going back to kind of the personal, you were working at a law firm in Atlanta, and then I know you have your own firm now. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
Sure. So let's see, it's been about 8 years ago where I went off on my own and started a home-based law firm. So we do all the same work that we did in the brick-and-mortar big law firm in the big building. We have the same systems, the servers, the docketing system, the assistants, the phone system, everything as if like a normal system, except I work at an office of my own. It's not always important to have to sit down with an inventor to see an invention, because a lot of it is system-based, and I do a lot of work that's circuit-based, and so all I have to do is send me a schematic diagram and talk me through the circuit, and I'll understand what it is, so I don't have
That's
to
cool.
meet them face-to-face. So
right.
then I don't have the overhead of the big building and all the equipment and, you know, paper
exactly.
and all that other stuff that the big business has or the big office building has. So I'm able to offer lower prices to my clients as well.
That's great. When we were talking last night, we were talking about if there are three aspects of an idea that are important, and one that it is patentable. Can you say that word for me, please?
Patentable.
Thank
it's
you.
It's not an easy word to say.
Gosh, it's such a tongue twister. I had no idea until trying to say it right now on the show. That is patentable, marketable, or both. Can you talk to some of us about that?
So we'll start with patentable, and there's three basic properties that an invention has to have to be patentable. It has to have utility, which means usefulness. And most things have some kind of use to them, so that's not a very hard thing to get over. The second is novelty, which is that no one else is doing the exact same thing that you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're coming up with a new idea, generally you can find the novelty. And there may be something that you're not aware of, but generally you can get past novelty without too much problem. The third part is non-obviousness, and that's the tough one. Because in the examination, the examiner can look at two different pieces of art and combine those together and say it would be obvious for one of ordinary skill in the art to combine this. And that's the hardest part. That's the biggest part of my job is convincing the examiner that it's not obvious to do so, or to find something else, some other aspect of the invention to add into the claims that it wouldn't be obvious in light of those two pieces of art. And I think there are two pieces. I mean, I've had five pieces of art combined together to get the invention that I'm describing the client. So,
okay. And then the marketable aspect.
Okay, so that's patentable. So the marketable aspect is something that will sell that the public wants to buy. So you have patentable. Something that may be patentable may not be marketable, right? Somebody, you know, it may be new and nobody else is doing it, but nobody wants to buy it. The other side is it could be marketable, but not patentable. So everybody wants to buy it, but it's too close to something that already exists.
That
if you combine the two together, correct. The third one is one that's both patentable and marketable. And those are the ideas that you really want to follow the patent on. Because if it's patentable and not marketable, you're spending a lot of money and a lot of time for something that you're never going to get your money back out of. If it's marketable but not patentable, obviously you're not going to want to file a patent on that because it's not patentable. So it'd be a
you don't need to. Right.
Right. But if it's patentable and marketable, then those are the ones that are important to file a patent on.
So once someone has their patent, what is it that you've seen happen? What are some next steps then, or the natural trajectory of what is next?
Well, I mean, ideally, If you have a patent on it, other people who are patent savvy will say, I want to stay away from that because I don't want to get involved in litigation and infringe their patent. But if you're an individual inventor and you have a patent and a big company wants to do it, it may be fiscally ideal for them to actually infringe the patent. Even though they're going at risk of litigation costs, they may be able to make more profit and maybe worth it to them. So,
well, it's been interesting.
They can throw a lot of money in. They can throw a lot of money in litigation with all their lawyers, whereas an individual inventor doesn't have the resources. So.
Yeah. You know, it's been interesting, and I know I mentioned to you in passing that since I got my patent, all these things started coming in the mail, and it, obviously our digital age, like all of a sudden these different companies know I have a patent, and I get these mailers on, you know, this company wants to build it, and that wants to build it, you know, at my cost, but it was just interesting to see how I started getting these unsolicited mailings about, you know, other patent-related things. And you had mentioned that you help people write grants, which is something I definitely want to talk with you privately because I think that's my next step with my patent. Yeah. Can you tell our listeners about that for someone who might be interested?
Okay, so the government has, and a lot of people don't know about these, there's small business grants where there are particular descriptions of things that each of the, or most of the government agencies support. So there'll be like NASA will have one, Department of Energy, Health and Human Resources. Each of the groups has a budget of money that they've allocated to supporting small business research. And one of them is called an SBIR, and those are the ones that the company gets does the research on its own. And the other one is an STTR, and that is where the company works with a university to do the research. So there's two different little areas to go into. But you'll have to search on the there's a central grant website. I'm not sure what that is offhand, but you can search for grants that are available in particular areas. And see if there's one that is directed toward what you're doing, and then you can write an application. Follow the application guidelines to try and get the grant.
So you're also available for hire to do this kind of work as well for your clients.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So one of the things go ahead.
One of my clients is in the middle. We've filed one application. And are in the middle of filing another one here at the end of January. The first one we filed was SBIR, and this one is an STTR. But it has to do with green energy. This client takes energy out of the air, basically, using graphite fibers. And,
is that the Ion Power Group that you've told me about?
Yes.
Okay, awesome.
Yes. I'm actually the CEO of the company as well. We're doing research right now. We've shown proof of concept of it, but we're trying to do research and increasing the altitude to see if we can get higher power out of it. And we expect that it's just an expensive undertaking to put something, these fibers up to 10,000 feet and get the readings off of it. So that's what we're working towards right now on that. I believe it's 10 patents issued now.
Wow.
Several in the U.S. and then internationally. We have patents issued in China, Japan, Russia, and Canada. And we still have several pending in the European Union as well.
This is so exciting. So the Ion Power Group, it's harvesting energy out of the air. Did you say at 10,000 feet?
Yes. So we tested at 130 feet. So the next step is for us to the target is to put a tethered balloon up to 10,000 feet and suspend the fibers off of that balloon, and then the tether is an actual it's got a cable inside the tether connected down to some kind of storage facility down at the ground to collect the energy that's received up to 10,000 feet.
Oh, that's so cool, Benji. And you're CEO of this company. Yeah. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, last night in preparation and speaking to you about this today on the show, I kind of binge watched Shark Tank. And they had a guy come on, and he wanted $2 million to harvest energy from waves, from like a wave park. And he had already invented something that kinetically charges a battery as you walk. And he had 10 patents that he had there, and none of the five sharks invested, you know, in him, because it seemed like he kind of came with two different ideas, wasn't very clear. But it was so cool, this concept of harvesting, you know, from the waves, energy. And so it just was interesting to me. He was the most well-articulated with kind of one of the most amazing ideas, yet didn't get one of the sharks to invest in his ideas, which is a bit disappointing because it's about clean energy. So what are y'all doing with the ION group? Like, how are y'all proceeding in your research and such?
Well, we're still trying to show how much energy you can get out of the process. And that's kind of where we stalled. We can do it out of, you know, a couple of fibers, but to install a large scale power plant type of facility, we're still looking for funding to do that. So, we're kind of sitting at the doorstep waiting to do that, to take the next step in the research, from the research side.
So would one of the grants that you mentioned a moment ago possibly apply in this process that you're involved in with energy?
Yeah, that's what we're hoping.
Oh, that's cool.
To get the grant to be able to do this, the next stage of testing it.
Very cool. So are you able to talk about some of the inventions that you've patented, or is that confidential?
Sure. Yeah, if they're patented, there's no problem. Actually, if they're filed and published, there's no problem because they're publicly available at the time. One of the ones I like to talk about is a lady that did a foot-operated door latch, and it's designed for public restrooms.
Mm.
So, you know, when you go to use a public restroom, you have to use the handle latch. Hers is a foot-operated latch, so it's at the bottom of the door, and you can use your foot to operate, so you don't have to touch anything.
That's cool.
Yeah, and so we've got a patent issued in the U.S., and I think we're pending in Australia and a couple other countries as well.
Very cool. I would love to see those.
Yeah, and a lot of the stuff that I do is internal and circuit-based, and so most people don't even want to. I'm just trying to understand the technology behind it.
Because it's so electronic.
It's interesting. Yeah, I had lunch with one of the older patent attorneys in Atlanta a couple years ago. And so one of my questions is similar. It's like, well, what are the neat things that you work on that I've heard of? And he said, you know, out of all the years that I've worked in patent law, he's about 30-something years, he said the only thing that I've done that actually you can find out in the industry is, or that you can personally buy, is it was some kind of filter for fuel. It was like a cone filter.
And
that's almost the only thing. So now on the trademark side, he had worked on some the cabbage pail kids or garbage pail kids.
Oh yeah.
There was a trademark infringement on that. And then a Domino's pizza versus a Domino's sugar. He had a little trademark case on that. But he said, you know, 30-something years, those are the only things that people would actually recognize that he's worked on. So a lot of it is internal things that you normally wouldn't see.
So that reminds me earlier, and I almost forgot, you were going to speak to us about the when you might need a patent versus a copyright versus a trademark.
Okay.
Can we talk about that?
So the patent, most of the time in the patent, it works on the functionality. That's the utility patent. It's how it works. There is a design side, there's a design patent, which is how it actually looks. But it's not like, it's not as far as a work of art. It's just the structure of, or the ornamentality of how something looks. So the classic way I like to describe it is the light fixtures. What the light fixture looks like and how it's got a curve to it in a certain place. That's something you can get a design patent for, but you can't get a utility patent for it because there's no functionality. Do that light fixture. This patent is basically on the functionality, except for that design patent part of it. There's also a plant patent, but that's very rare for most people. It's how you, I haven't actually never even worked on one. That's how rare they are. Practice is. Another side is the trademark, and the trademark protects the origination of the goods and services. So when you see the arches, you know that that's products from McDonald's. You know the origination of that good, so that hamburger that you bought. And then the copyright protects a work of art, whether it's music, writing, books, a sculpture, any kind of work of art. That's what a copyright does. A copyright you actually have once you produce it, but to get protection from the act, the federal act, you have to actually file it, which is very simple to do. It's cheap. You go onto the copyright website, and I think it's $30, $35 for a fee, and all you do is fill out a form and submit a copy of your work.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
I have a trademark on, so you helped me with the patent that is for a nonprofit that I founded, a 501c3 called the Yes Foundation. And an artist in Louisiana did a beautiful logo for the Yes Foundation that I trademarked so no one else could use it. And I filed through the Secretary of State, you know, for that image to be trademarked.
Okay, you have a state trademark but not a federal trademark.
Exactly.
Okay.
I didn't realize there were two different ones, so that's good to know. I'm going to put this on my list.
So you're protected, right? So you're protected in the state that you filed that in because you filed it with the Secretary of State. To have it federally protected, you have to file it with the Patent and Trademark Office.
Okay, thank you for that. And to our listeners, do you see how you get the sense of how complex these laws are and how much there is to them? So I'm glad we're doing this show because I can get with you about that as well.
That's right.
So what else is important for our listeners to know related to these topics?
I think the main thing that I would stress in this, and you can back me up on this, is it's much better to spend the money up front and have a patent attorney do the work with their knowledge and their expertise than to try and do it yourself.
Yes.
And then have to come in and fix it later on. Because you were lucky in the one that we've gone so far in that we were able to do the fixes to get it allowed.
Yes.
I have another client that he filed a provisional application which it isn't examined, and it just saves your filing date. But you have to file a non-provisional application within a year. Well, when you file it, and if you file it by mail, you have to file it by first-class mail and get the filing receipt so you have proof on when you put it in the mail, in the mailbox, in the mail system. He didn't do that. He just filed it by regular mail, put it in his mailbox. But it doesn't have proof on it. So he missed that date, and we were unable to go back and get the filing date of the provisional. So his filing date was then when the patent office received that new application.
Application.
So, yeah.
No,
so
I definitely.
Over a year.
I definitely back you up with, for our listeners, to go to someone, to go to Benji, for example, and have him streamline this process for you, because I spent 6 years navigating it on my own, and I learned a lot, but if I had it to do over, it would have been much less stressful to come to you with my idea and have you, you know, coach me and take these steps in a more streamlined and affordable manner than doing it on your own.
Right, and you'll have a much better chance of getting the broadest coverage and everything that you should get when you may not realize what you're doing when you try and do it on your own.
Exactly. So I like to ask all of my guests, what is it that they would like to leave? You know, and you know, I'm hearing your uncle was a big influence in a positive way in your life and sounds like an amazing man, still, you know, working as a patent attorney in Los Angeles at age 82, and the memories of him showing you cool things when you were young that influenced you to want to do the same work. What might you want to leave as a legacy or history or and such?
I just want to be seen as somebody that enjoys life, you know, and that's something that that I do. I work to live, not live to work. I enjoy what I do, and when I'm working on it, But, you know, when I finally am gone from here, I want people to celebrate my life, not be sad that I'm gone.
Yeah.
You know, I guess that's kind of the most important thing to me.
And you have a son, right?
I have two sons and a daughter. Daughter is 28.
Okay.
Son is 22, and then one that is 15.
Are any of your children, by chance, interested in following in this regard professionally?
The middle one may get there eventually. He kind of sees what I do and what I work with. And he wants to do that, but I don't know if he wants to go through all the work to get there. Because like we talked about, it's kind of a long road to get to that, to become a patent attorney.
It is.
So, yeah. But we'll see.
Yeah, you'll definitely see. Well, Benji, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. And I want to let our listeners know that you can find attorney Benji Balzer online at NextIP, like intellectual property law.com. NextIPlaw.com. And I appreciate you personally that you helped me so much in having a patent, which has been just a dream come true. Thank you.
Sure, Lisa. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. We'll talk soon.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. That concludes today's show. Join me next Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific time for another guest that I bring you on a different topic. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir, only on LA Talk Radio.